hauled off to jail. And then he was offered diversion because it was his first offense, but he could not come up with the money. It was more than $3,000 it would have cost him to do diversion. And so he ended up convicted and now is carrying a felony record around with him for this drunken episode.
Are there any national standards?
There are national standards, but they're not binding. I mean, people have been really thoughtful and come up with standards for how these programs should work. You shouldn't have to plead guilty. Fees should not keep you out of it. But that doesn't mean prosecutors have to follow them.
Well, we will link to your pieces in the New York Times, Shyla Dewan, national correspondent. The recent series, No Money, No Mercy, which examines how money undermines reforms to America's criminal justice system. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina Gester, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Laguerre, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee, third Wednesday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Buyer and Seller, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Buyer and Seller, the story of an underemployed Los Angeles actor who goes to work in Barbara Streisand's Malibu, California basement, allowing for delicious wit and commentary on the solitude of celebrity, the love-hate attraction between gay men and divas, and the melancholy that lurks beneath narcissism. Again, that's Buyer and Seller, November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the weather is staying below freezing, but citizen activists will be going out tonight to find houseless people in need.
And the city of Portland is building a pod village in North Portland's Kenton neighborhood for houseless women.
And in a special extended KBOO News in Depth, Kanan Schlesinger reports on institutional racism within the Oregon Department of Corrections.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 15th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. The National Weather Service has forecasted severe weather conditions in Multnomah County on Thursday, December 15th, with the potential to continue through Monday, December 19th. Portland is forecasted to have a wind chill in the low 20s on Thursday night. Wind chill in the low 20s to upper teens are forecasted for Gresham on Thursday night, with a 20% chance of snow showers after 10 p.m. Those seeking relief from winter weather in Multnomah County find a list of warming centers and shelters online at 211.org/emergency. That's 211.org/emergency. Among the day shelters are warming centers that are or may be open are TPI's Imago Day Shelter and Bud Clark Commons, Dignity Village and Union Gospel Mission Downtown, St. Francis in Southeast, and the St. John's Warming Center, the Native American Youth and Family Center on Northeast Columbia, and Outside Inn.
A small group of everyday people who care about the houseless community has kicked into overdrive over the past 48 hours to make sure that no vulnerable people suffer or die outside in the cold. Tonight, activists will be scattering across the metro area to find houseless people with no place to go and bring them to homemade warming shelters, including one at Jesse Sponberg's Garage Project. One such superhero is Greg Liascos. Lisa Loving spoke with him this afternoon about what he's going to be doing tonight and how you can help also.
Well, today's kind of exciting. Jesse Sponberg is putting his house up for the night and perhaps tomorrow as well as a warming shelter. So we're going to put together some people to drive around and just round up people who are wet and cold. Last night, our friend Sammy, who's one of our really great volunteers, you know, big heart on Sammy, she found a woman at the bus stop who was cold and wet and huddling and crying on the ground, and not in a good way. So, you know, we ran her clothes. I didn't take pants, and I didn't realize that by the time I got there, she would need pants. But I had coveralls, so I gave her pants and wore my coveralls home. Now, Sammy managed to get the train station security, who close up and kick everybody out at night, to agree to let her sleep there all night until she could get on a train tomorrow, which would be today, of course. So as a result, Jesse decided he's going to do this thing with his house, and I've got people in my house now cooking soup. That'd be Allison and a bunch of kids. I think Sunshine at the house is doing it too. So then we're going to take all of this food over to Jesse's house and get things set up with all of the blankets and stuff that everybody still has for donation. Then we'll get cars running around looking for people who, you know, might want to go to the shelter, and maybe take people in twos and threes. And just feed them, and, you know, they'll have access to a shower, and there's enough firewood to get through the weekend, and then the snowpocalypse will be over.
Greg, are you part of some super fancy nonprofit with, you know, glass and fern? Who are you working with?
My favorite people to work with are, well, Jesse Sponberg got me started. He actually showed me I had the ability to give myself permission to do these things. And before, I didn't really believe that. I didn't understand. Until you get your hands in this, you just don't really understand sometimes. And, you know, through the great work that he does, putting up other people together, that's like his superpowers, putting other people together, right? All these other good things he does, they're great, but that's his superpower. Now, with Fight Church and the Garage Project, that really got things moving along, and I got to meet some really wonderful people, including Free Hot Soup, Backpacks of Hope, you know. And the more I got into it, the more beautiful the people that I, you know, I would see. These souls are like the glowing, shiniest, brightest things in the city, you know. And these are poor people too, you know. Anyway, so these are the places that we're working with, and we're all kind of collaborating on a whole bunch of different projects together. And right now, you know, there's a lot of room for volunteers too, so I'm going to plug that. We have access most weeks to more food than we can possibly distribute to the hungry, cold people, because it rots before we can get it there, because we don't have enough volunteers on the regular. So right now, I know Free Hot Soup does Director Park downtown, and they do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Now one of our Wednesday cooks is actually, you remember a few weeks ago at the protest when they arrested me in the Pikachu costume? One of the, in the cooling tank, there was a cook on my left and a cook on my right. Both of these guys about to lose their jobs. They had never been arrested, and they had to be at work at 11 a.m. and they couldn't call in from the cooling tank, you know? So the one guy says, if I don't call in or get there, I'm going to be fired. The other guy says, if I don't call in or, you know, I'm going to be fired. So I said, well, you guys should exchange restaurant informations so you can have each other's jobs if you don't get to keep your own. One of these guys found me on Facebook, and he's been cooking for us. And it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So, yeah, these are the things that we're working on. And you know, there's more to come.
How do people connect with you if they want to help?
Look up Free Hot Soup on Facebook. Look up Backpacks of Hope on Facebook. Look up Fight Church on Facebook. Look up The Garage Project on Facebook. You can look up, you know, me, Greg Liascos, on Facebook. You can look up Jesse Sponberg on Facebook. All kinds of community elements are coming together all the time for these projects. You know, I won't get into exactly the things that are happening, but even the Analog Cafe, you know, Donnie Reif has been helping us out with some things. You know, we do a free self-defense class there on Sundays now because of the new Trump era. You know, this defense class is based on unwanted male contact. If somebody puts their hand on you, I can show you how to take it and break it. And, you know, Donnie's letting us use his place for that because he's a really good human being. The Ash Street Saloon, they've been working with us on some projects too, but we'll get into that once they're solidified.
Right on. So I just want to thank you for being here, Greg Liascos.
Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Mayor Charlie Hales has a plan to ease the struggle for homeless women. The Portland Mercury learned that Hales wants to build a cluster of sleeping pods in North Portland's Kenton neighborhood. A PDF of the Argyle Village proposal describes it as a partnership between the city's Joint Office of Homeless Services and Catholic Charities inspired by Opportunity Village in Eugene. The proposal reads, quote, "The residency model consists of 14 female residents residing in a transitional basis in a village-style community that includes self-governance by the residents as well as oversight and ongoing support from a contracted nonprofit. The site at 2221 North Argyle, owned by the Portland Development Commission, hopes to be ready by February. An advocacy group called the Village Coalition recently built and debuted the first set of sleeping pods in Kenton using $35,000 in city funds."
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is considering national rule changes to short-term lending. So-called debt traps from payday lending can lead families to skimp on their food budgets. KBOO's Stephen Oster has the story.
While the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau mulls over national rule changes to short-term lending, Oregon families have already been hurt and could even go hungry trying to pay back loans. Oregon offers a little more protection. It is among the 18 states with some regulations on payday lending, including a 36% interest rate cap annually. But families still fall into the lending debt trap and especially are at risk while spending during the holiday season. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum says payday loans put people in difficult positions.
If a debtor is faced with unaffordable payments on their payday-type loans, then they're having to choose between defaulting, between reborrowing, and between skipping their other financial obligations, like their rent or their basic living expenses, like food and medical care.
The proposed CFPB rule changes to payday and car title lending include a requirement by lenders to establish a consumer's ability to repay and limiting consumers to one loan at a time. Republican members of Congress have criticized the proposed change as a set of onerous regulations on the industry. Jeff Kleen is a public policy advocate at Oregon Food Bank. He spoke to a woman about how she got out from under her short-term lending debt.
The way that she finally climbed out of that debt trap was to skimp on groceries. And this is a single mom with three daughters, and all of them had to cut back on the amount of food that they were eating.
He says Oregonians spent $16 million on fees for payday and car title loans last year before interest payments on those loans even started. Rosenblum encourages Oregonians to think long and hard before taking out a short-term loan.
Please make sure that you do have the ability to repay on the terms that you have committed to, because otherwise the collateral consequences, the closing of bank accounts, the seizure of cars and such is going to unfortunately make for some very unhappy holidays.
New rules from the CFPB are expected to be announced in 2017. For KBOO News, I'm Stephen Oster, reporting.
Portland picked up a trend spreading throughout the Northwest on Wednesday by approving a new zoning rule that bans new fossil fuel terminals within the city. Because of its location at the intersection of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, Portland is a fossil fuel hub for the state. KBOO's Tony Letigre has more.
Communities throughout the Northwest are rejecting fossil fuel infrastructures, and on Wednesday, Portland went a step further by approving a new zoning rule that bans large fossil fuel terminals from coming to the city. Dan Sears, conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper, says Northwest cities stand at the gate of Asian markets, but many have rejected large natural gas and oil terminals typically used for exporting fossil fuels across the Pacific.
What Portland is doing fits into a broader context throughout the region, and it's really impressive to see city council taking this step that really pushes the ball forward and sets an example that these other places can follow.
Portland City Council unanimously approved the measure. Critics are concerned the proposal could hurt fuel supplies for the state because Portland is Oregon's largest fossil fuel hub. Supporters say the measure will help reduce the likelihood of potential disasters, such as the derailment of an oil train in Mosier this past summer. Sears says cities in Oregon have begun to put in place innovative ways to reduce their reliability on fossil fuels. He says cities probably will play a larger role in fighting climate change in the wake of the presidential election. Many of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominations question whether climate change is a man-made phenomenon.
The clear sense that people had from that election is that the federal government will likely not be taking meaningful action to curb the worst impacts of climate change.
The ban only affects storage tanks with a capacity of 2 million gallons or more. Facilities can grow by 10% if they choose to replace storage tanks with seismically upgraded ones. For the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, this is Tony LaTigra.
Facebook has announced a new tool to combat fake news on its site. The company will make it easier for users to flag news articles that may be fake or misleading. Facebook will work with fact-checking organizations like Snopes, ABC News, and the Associated Press. Stories that are deemed as fake will be labeled and buried in a user's newsfeed.
A pipeline in Billings County, Montana, sprang a leak, spilling 176,000 gallons of very crude oil just 150 miles from Standing Rock. The Belle Fourche pipeline, built in the 1980s, leaked into Ash Coulee Creek 10 days ago, but was only detected and reported within the last couple of days. The spillage was discovered the same day that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers disapproved construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline beneath the Missouri River. Here in Portland, warm-hearted folks will brave cold weather to put on two more benefit concerts for Standing Rock, both tonight and tomorrow. Portland Rocks with Standing Rock takes place tonight at 8 to 11 p.m. at Dante's at 350 West Burnside Street. Tomorrow evening, the Eagle's Nest at 4904 Southeast Hawthorne will host a PDX hip-hop benefit for Standing Rock, kicking off at 8:30 p.m. Both events will feature performances of native elder speakers with the aim of collecting funds and donations for the protest camps in North Dakota.
This week, President-elect Donald Trump added three more names to his passel of fossil fuel hawks nominated for cabinet positions. Joining Oklahoma Attorney General and climate change denier Scott Pruitt, who is named for the EPA, are climate skeptic and Montana Republican Congressman Ryan Zink for Department of the Interior, and ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State. Also, former Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who is, by the way, a board member of Energy Transfer Partners, will lead the Department of Energy, which is an agency that he has avowed to destroy. Stoking concerns of an ideological purge at the Energy Department, the transition team has asked for a list of staffers who did any work on climate change. Well, so far, the department is refusing to comply with this request. But several U.S. governors, mayors, and environmental justice advocates say that there are ways to do an end run around potentially anti-climate policies of the Trump administration. FSRN's Larry Buell has more on this.
No, I think the momentum is unstoppable now. We're winning this. We're going to win it. There is a serious question as to how fast we will win it.
That's former Vice President and climate activist Al Gore on MSNBC last week, sharing his optimism about reversing climate change, no matter what the incoming Trump administration does. The choices for Trump's cabinet and advisors have signaled that the incoming president could roll back gains like the Paris Accord and a bilateral U.S.-China climate deal, and fail to enforce EPA regulations, or even eliminate those regulations. But many U.S. governors and mayors are promising to block climate-hostile federal actions in any way they can. California Governor Jerry Brown's choice for a state attorney general, Congressman Javier Becerra, has promised to use a state's rights argument to block EPA rules, echoing tactics used by Republicans to block various initiatives during President Obama's tenure. Environment advocates say California will continue to be an international player in climate change. Ann Nottoff is the California director for the National Resources Defense Council.
Now, here in California, and actually in Oregon and Washington as well, we have a Pacific Coast Climate Initiative, where the governors of all three states, along with British Columbia, have signed statements and executed their own program.
California can't join the UN process because it's not a nation, but it has a lot of bilateral commitments to work with other countries and other regions.
Julia Forgy is an Emmett Frankel Fellow in Environmental Policy at the UCLA School of Law. She says one of California's bilateral commitments is to the Under 2 Coalition, That's a group of 165 subnational governments which have agreed to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. And she says AGs in California and in other states can use the courts to slow walk federal changes that would impact their states.
At the state level, the AG should ensure that any legislation and any regulations coming out of California are really bulletproof and won't be susceptible to any sort of federal preemption arguments or any dormant commerce clause concerns, because those are two things that have, I guess, set back some of the California regulations.
The dormant commerce clause means a state cannot discriminate against or unduly burden interstate commerce. Governor Brown is trying a preemptive approach to oil drilling. Tuesday, he asked President Obama to issue a permanent moratorium on new drilling leases off the California coast before he steps down. Local municipalities are also taking a stand. Last month, 35 self-described climate mayors sent a letter to Trump urging climate action and support for city-based initiatives. But that doesn't mean they're expecting a response. Ann Nothoff says mayors, along with governors, can be a front line against hostile federal actions. She points out that even though there could be more oil and gas leasing on federal land, local governments do have options.
They could be up against federal land, but what happens on private land next to the federal land can often have an impact on the direction of federal land management as well.
At the grassroots level, activists say they'll be very busy, not only on climate change, but on local issues like air quality and water safety.
What this election does is it wakes up individuals to realize that the government doesn't necessarily take care of them, that they're actually in charge of the narratives of their government, and so they have to be vocal.
Leah Garland is on the steering committee of the grassroots environmental nonprofit SoCal 350. She says knowing local politicians, knowing what issues are at stake, and even how to show up at city council meetings, all of those things matter just as much as voting for environmentally friendly politicians.
Consequently, since the election, many people who in the past have been just giving money to charity are now saying, what can I do? And that kind of realization that they're not passive participants in our democracy, I feel means that we now have an opportunity to help people become more participatory.
While President-elect Trump's cabinet picks are nearly all staunchly pro-fossil fuel and skeptical of global warming science, climate activists say they are energized, ready to fight, and they have a lot of allies. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Ohio Governor John Kasich vetoed a measure that would have outlawed abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, while approving a law that prevents an abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy. That's 4 weeks earlier than the current Ohio law. The vetoed heartbeat bill would have mandated the nation's strictest time limit, banning abortions at around 6 weeks. Similar measures passed in Arkansas and North Dakota were found to be unconstitutional in federal court. The new law makes Ohio the latest state this year to pass a 20-week ban on abortions following Georgia and South Carolina. 43 states restrict abortions, with some exceptions, by time or phase of fetal development.
A Louisiana judge threw out an executive order protecting the rights of gay and transgender people. Judge Todd Hernandez of the 19th Judicial District Court ruled that Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards' order was unconstitutional because it unlawfully usurped the power vested in Louisiana's legislative branch. The executive order was also intended to protect state employees from discrimination based on race, religion, disability, and age. The order had been challenged in court by Louisiana State Attorney General Jeff Landry. Landry is a Republican who describes himself as a, quote, campaigner for conservative family values. Governor Edwards expressed great disappointment in the ruling and said he planned to appeal it. This is not the first time that LGBT protections have been attacked in conservative southern states. The most contentious example is probably the North Carolina law that bars transgender people from using public bathrooms that do not match the sex on their birth certificates. Statewide backlash from that law is believed to be a key reason that North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory failed in his re-election bid.
Yeah. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with Sequoia Wright. Tomorrow's weather, the snow is staying, but it won't get any deeper. Mostly sunny skies and highs around 33 degrees. Today in history, in 1791, the Bill of Rights was passed into law. The quote of the day is from U.S. Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, author of War is a Racket, who said, quote, "There are only two things that we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights."
The Senate of Brazil approved a constitutional amendment Tuesday that establishes a cap on public spending. This effectively freezes health and education spending for the next 20 years. Brazil's government, which took power only 6 months ago after then-President Dilma Rousseff was impeached and removed from office, defends the move as a bitter but necessary measure to get Brazil's failing economy back on track. But critics, including the United Nations, have blasted the measure, saying that it will punish the poorest and will reverse decades of social progress. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
Senhor Presidente, todos os requerimentos foram apresentados no mesmo momento, Senhor Presidente.
Senators voted 53-19 Tuesday in favor of a constitutional amendment to freeze public spending levels for 20 years, allowing only for inflation rate adjustments. The measure, known as PEC 55, is the most ambitious austerity move yet from the government of Michel Temer. The former vice president who took power 6 months ago after the suspension and later impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. Enshrining the measure in the constitution will make the unelected administration's policy more difficult to overturn in the future. The Temer government, which is unpopular and scandal-plagued, defends the move as a bitter but necessary pill to get Brazil's flailing economy back on track. Critics say the public spending cap will disproportionately affect Brazil's poorest, who rely on the country's already precarious social safety net. By limiting spending on a growing population, they say, the government is effectively reducing investment on an already overwhelmed system, which could force further privatizations. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston, called PEC 55 a, quote, "radical measure, lacking in all nuance and compassion." In Sao Paulo, demonstrators shot bottle rockets and fireworks at the building of City and State Industry Federation, which was a big driver of Dilma Rousseff's impeachment. The measure takes effect this week. Sam Cowie for FSRN, Sao Paulo.
Alleged tampering with the U.S. election by state-sponsored Russian hackers went further than just attempting to influence the Clinton campaign, reports the New York Times. It also extended to intruding on the campaigns of several Democratic candidates for the House. Unidentified Russians made available to reporters and bloggers thousands of pages of documents stolen by hackers from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in Washington. This is an attack by a foreign actor that had intent to disrupt our election. And we're the victims of it, says Kelly Ward, executive director of the DCCC. Intrusions in House races were reported in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Ohio, Illinois, New Mexico, and North Carolina. The hackers used social media to encourage reporters to request specific caches of documents. The Times says an arrangement that many news outlets welcomed, thereby amplifying consequences of the cyber attack. The attack is believed to have taken place in April of this year. Congressional seats that the hackers targeted in the document dumps included some of the most competitive races in the country.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony LaTigre, Stephen Oster, Kanan Schlesinger, and Martin Dodge. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn talk with community organizer, activist, author Starhawk. At 9 it's Veterans Voice Radio. Angie and Marvin welcome Air Force veteran Phoenix to the KBOO studios to reflect on her time spent at Standing Rock. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, Radio Zone present the broadcast, independent investigative news, interviews, and commentary. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched 1-to-1 through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click donate.
Good night, Grace Ann.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
Good night.
In Oregon prisons, no one can hear your cries for justice, no one can hear about the abuse you experience, and apparently there really isn't a way to report it internally. This is especially the case when your every attempt at documenting, reporting, or complaining about your living conditions or your mistreatment is met with retaliation, or at least the threat of. In Oregon prisons managed by the state's Department of Corrections, being an inmate of color leaves little, if any, recourse for injuries, emotional, mental, or physical, created or made worse by staff operating and managing these prisons. In Oregon's 6 biggest prisons, a program called Security Threat Management operates under the auspices of the Inspector General of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Under the Security Threat Management Program, or STM, 6 lieutenants are appointed directly by the Inspector General to directly identify and deal with every inmate they see at any given moment as threatening. And on top of this, all staff working within these prisons are deputized to identify and gather information on those they deem threats to the security to the prison or its occupants, both inmate and staff. Culturally, among prison staff, when an inmate is identified as high risk, under STM, they are often assumed to be involved in gang activity or criminal activity, such as trafficking drugs within the prison system. In prison guard jargon, these are called strategic threat groups. What happens as a result of STM's mandate is that Gestapo-style information gathering is permitted, and every inmate that displays what is perceived as threatening behavior can be threatened with or targeted with STM repercussions. STM gets compliance out of inmates by coercion, though on paper, Oregon Department of Corrections states that incentives, such as better housing and transfers to minimum security facilities, are dangled above their heads as carrots, as a reporter for the Oregonian put it. In practice, STM lieutenants use what few things inmates have available to them in prison and threaten to take them away to force them into compliance. A common tactic is unannounced relocation to facilities further away from inmates' families. Another is arbitrary and unexplained putting inmates in the hole, or solitary confinement, sometimes for years on end. STM permits guards and lieutenants to confiscate all of an inmate's possessions, issue a 120-day ban from recreation in prison yards, and ban them from making purchases at the prison canteen or from socializing with other prisoners at all during mealtime. These are only the most common punitive actions used by the STM. Since STM was initiated in 2007, there's been little evidence to show that it has done anything to reduce violence. In fact, from 2012 to 2013, despite overall lower rates in assault, there were more inmates that were repeat offenders of prison guard assault, which could suggest that inmates targeted by the high alert system are actually being pushed beyond their limits and aggravated by STM lieutenants to the point where they're lashing out with physical violence. In order to draw attention to the human rights and dignity violations being committed with impunity, Portland-based organizers traveled to Salem 2 weeks ago to demonstrate and march in defiance of institutional racism in prisons. Teresa Rayford with Don't Shoot PDX and Maria Garcia, owner of the activist-friendly Revolucion Coffee House, led a demonstration that confronted Oregon Department of Corrections staffers in front of the DOC headquarters. They both called out by name STM Lieutenant Douglas Yancey, who allegedly is responsible for egregious human rights abuses within DOC facilities.
I'm talking about all the inmates, you know, in general. And so his name, you know, is Douglas Yancey. You know, we have many complaints, emails, phone calls of inmates, well, not directly emails, but the families, you know. We have some testimonies, and we want you to take a deeper look into this issue, you know, together maybe the Inspector General, I don't know. We know that Douglas Yancey responds to the Inspector General, right? So we just want this harassment and intimidation to stop.
So not what just we're here today is the people that we've worked with that have basically testified to us that they've had issues is that we want the Department of Corrections to do an immediate outside investigation. We understand that from our conversations that the Inspector General has given us a report that he had found no wrongdoing. What we would like is a full investigation of all of the claims that we brought to the table, as well as some reporting and audits of the complaint filing process. Where does that process go? How does it work? And what is the follow-up? We need to see that measurable outcomes in the whole filing complaint process, because racial intimidation has escalated since the campaigning of Donald Trump. And we know that in January, there's going to be an additional rise to that. We need the systems in Oregon that are respectful to the needs of people that are not only incarcerated in our jail systems, but also facilitating the safety of our children and our education systems. We need them to give us clear levels of opportunity to know that when an issue is brought up, that there is going to be an investigation, that we're not going to use conversations to mediate these issues, that a zero tolerance hate ban on language that we know is affiliated with racial violence and sexual violence, that there's an immediate ban. We can't afford the luxury of mediating these issues away, and we can't have the luxury of saying that hate speech in Oregon is free speech. We need systems that contain human bodies to have the human rights and dignity and have the foresight to put some type of conditioning in their existing policy that keeps safety and protocol in an established format.
Well, and I think it's significant for you to know, too. I mean, we've already had several times. We're going to meet again and have a conversation. Mm-hmm. I think we sent that out to other representatives. So as an agency, we're going to go ahead and meet as soon as we set that time in January.
Right, but we want to make sure that there's policies in place that show, like, we've asked for the reporting and auditing of how those, from the time that somebody makes a complaint, I would like to see it. We need to see what does the reporting look like? What does the auditing that we're asking for look like in terms of this is how many complaints were filed, this is how the complaints were handled, and these are the outcomes, this is how we follow up. Those are the things that I would like. I said that at the first time that we had the meeting.
After the protest, I reached out to Gary Johnson, the administrator of diversity and inclusion, heard speaking in the clip, for comment. And he responded with a message stating that all allegations of hate crimes and discrimination are investigated fully. He also pointed out that they've been working with local civil rights groups for several months, and that a forthcoming meeting in January seeks to address any transparency and disciplinary issues. What Gary Johnson didn't mention is that the group he was referring to is composed of Teresa and Maria, heard earlier, as well as the head of the Oregon ACLU and a representative from Portland-based Latinx advocacy group, VOS. I regrouped with Teresa and Maria after the protest to talk more about Yancey and the DOC inmates they've been in contact with.
Last year, we went to the Oregon Department of Corrections to ask for the same thing because the safety in jails
has escalated to the biggest issues, because we have European Kindred, which is the famous Russell Cordier's group, inside of those jails. And what we're learning in the school district is that they have children that are already calling themselves little Nazis. And the thing is our political structure here in Oregon, which allows hate speech, that's the determining factor of where a lot of people get their power. I think that those limitations on what we call free speech or the opportunity for hate speech to be protected, I think that that was done in reference and support of legislators and politicians who in the past have used that type of language. We already know very clearly that the KKK helped institute our constitution and the language that doctrinates how our society runs and is governed here in Oregon. I'm sure that everybody knows that a lot of these streets and buildings are named after well-known racists, and that our politics have always been in bed with racism and the white supremacy authoritarian. And right now we're being flooded.
And so can you talk about the Department of Corrections and what has been coming out from family members and friends of inmates?
Well, there's been a lot of interracial issues that are happening, assault, sexual violence, things of that sort in the jail systems. And when people of color are complaining about these things, what's happening is that there's a correction officer named Sergeant Yancey, I believe, that is one of the leaders in this. He works with the European Kindred, and they're used as a vehicle to basically keep things in line. But it's a physical vehicle. It's used as an assaulting vehicle, and it's basically the same, like I said, the same group as Russell Cordier. What we thought that we could do by going out to the Oregon Department of Corrections in protest is having them be responsible for recording and filing investigations for those people that have been making the complaints to them. Because what we've seen is that the families are helping their loved ones file these complaints and no one's doing anything, because their internal affairs and the inspector general basically does their investigation internally. We're asking for outside agencies in our school districts as well as in our prison systems to come in and to not only monitor what's happening, but to audit their reporting systems and help us define policy that can help us create systems that would help us get past, leaving these complaints on the table. We need them to turn into investigations.
What do you think comes next then? You mentioned on Friday that a Department of Justice investigation is one possible course of action. Is there any other alternative in terms of outside investigative authority that you would like to see come into these institutions and break up the institutionalized racism and the abuse that's happening?
Well, I can tell you right now, some of the supporters of Don't Shoot Portland have already spent thousands of dollars on outside investigators to basically take the complaints and to file, research, to do their own research to see if we can accommodate that research with the investigation process. And we keep hitting those same walls. It's basically based on our state constitution and our laws. These people don't have to do too much of anything that we ask them to do, even when you have your own investigator. So the biggest thing that we do is utilize the Department of Justice. I really do think that the Department of Justice here in Oregon is a joke, because we know that they pro organizations and activists. They're not too inclined to investigate things that need to be investigated. So I'm hoping that by doing the direct actions that we prompt the United States Department of Justice to take us a little seriously. And we're hoping that family members, people that know that these protests are happening, that have children that are in the schools and people that work in the workforce and people that are housed in these correction facilities, that they'll say, oh, well, this is where we can take our complaint, and that they'll be flooded with complaints through the United States Department of Justice. And then maybe we can get some probes that will matter. And if nothing else, in February, our legislators will see that that's where we're going, and they'll start enacting policies that ban hate speech and basically help us get the investigations covered.
He's been creating all these false reports. Like in this case, my friend was created a false report about being a gang-affiliated member and, distributing drugs inside jail. And that's, we know that's false. We know that's not true. And Rafael was dismissed of all those charges. During his hearing, and this is the way how they conduct investigations. So the second meeting we talk about this, their answer was that they investigated, Rafael, and their final answer was that he was an instigator and that he deserved to be into rivers, and they weren't going to bring him back. But his investigation, I mean, their investigation were based on, you know, going back to the source of who created all this mess, which is Douglas Yancey. You know, we gave them names of other inmates that have been, you know, suffering retaliation because they don't want to cooperate with investigations of Douglas Yancey, you know, when they're investigating about drugs and different issues that is happening or that are happening inside OSP, right? So how this man works, he just, you know, works with his informants and gives them soda tickets and gives them, you know, just whatever stuff, you know, they handle, you know, they run inside a jail that obviously is forbidden. But, you know, he promised them not to move them to different institutions because he has the power of moving inmates, you know, to different institutions. So that's why my friend was sent to Two Rivers together with these other guys. So I gave Inspector General a list of the of names, you know, four or five inmates that we were advocating for, and, you know, my friend Rafael and other guys that we were requesting to bring them back. And, you know, they never investigate any of these guys. They never contact them, you know. And, again, their investigation was based on going back to the source of the problem, which is Douglas Yancey, right?
KBOO Evening News also gained access to the testimony from these inmates gathered by Don't Shoot PDX over the last couple of months. The following clips recorded from phone interviews with the inmates have not previously been released to the public.
So I haven't really spoken much about this whole Yancey issue just because, you know, I'm afraid of the retaliation with these guys. And
right.
He's one of the guys that he's called me in his office probably four or five times over the past few years, and it's always to get information, you know, wanting me to collaborate with him. And he tries to be nice and give me some information here, give me some information there, and I'm not going to play that game. I've already told him once and twice, and it's just I'm putting my safety and well-being at risk. I don't know what else to say about the guy. I mean, honestly, he's just it's all bad with him. He's just pressuring people and scaring them. And the last incident I had with him, too, before that, and I never said anything about that, you know,